Welcome back to another amazing episode of Politateen, where high schoolers Varun Katathala and Damian Galvin engage in perspective-filled conversations on America's most pressing issues. Visit www.politateen.com for more content. Happy listening, guys.
And we're rolling. Hello, everybody. Welcome back to another episode of Politateen. My name is Damian Galvin, and as always, I'm joined by my wonderful co-host, Varun.
Hello, everybody. My name is Varun Katathala, and I'm the co-host of this podcast here with Damien for another amazing episode of Politateen with a very special guest once again, probably our most special guest, yes, Damien. His name is Eric Schultz. He was the former Deputy White House Press Secretary under the Obama administration, and he now works as a political advisor under Obama post-presidency. An amazing guest to have on today. Mr. Schultz, how are you doing?
Great. Thank you. Flattery will get you everywhere, so keep it coming.
Yeah, absolutely. Our first question for you, Eric, is how did you get into this field? We always ask our guests as the first question, how did they get into politics or how did they get into comedy? How did you decide to what series of events led you down this this career path?
You bet. So I have worked in campaigns and in government in politics for about 15 or almost two decades now, 15 years, 20 years. And my first job was on then Hillary Clinton's, I'm then First Lady Hillary Clinton's Senate campaign in New York in 2000. Mm-hmm. I'm guessing, I don't even know if you two were born yet.
We were not.
Yeah, that's pretty scary.
4 years out.
Yeah.
That's pretty horrendous. and I, you know, think for most of your listeners, but I was in college then, and obviously it was sort of the first campaign of its kind. No first lady had ever run for office in her own right before. And on that race, I was the tracker. And so that meant I sort of followed around our opponent with a video camera, trying to get him either screwing up or slipping or making mistakes or saying something stupid. And back then it wasn't like the iPhone where you just sort of use the video camera. It was like a big, sort of a huge sort of on your shoulder camera, video camera. And so I wasn't very discreet and I wasn't very good at sort of like sneaking into things. But it was the first experience I had where I got to sort of see the value of a communications operation. Mm-hmm. And given the nature of the race and who she was, I was, you know, like 20 years old and sort of found myself with working with some of the most impressive people in Democratic politics.
Yeah.
And I got to sort of see firsthand what effective and aggressive communications operation was like, you know, shaping coverage, working reporters, working stories with reporters, seeding stories about your opponent, all of the sort of stuff you see now that's sort of in how people deal with press. I got sort of a firsthand seat, first row seat early on. And that's what I knew I wanted to do. And so I went back to school. I graduated from Washington University in St. Louis. And then after that, I just came to Capitol Hill and I came to Washington and started knocking on doors. And until somebody would hire me, started out as a press intern, then a press assistant. And from there, just sort of, you know, had a bunch of roles that where eventually sort of got to the White House.
And that's an amazing story, Eric. I mean, you know, me and Damian think of that as very inspiring because me and Damian always talk about wanting to get into politics super young. We want to get into politics right now, but obviously we're in high school. We can't do that. But it's an amazing field to get into. You know, beyond that, it's just such an inspirational story you have. But my first question for you is, we have two contentious Senate seats in Georgia with Raphael Warnock and John Ossoff both vying for the Democratic seat in those Senate races. And those are, you know, going to determine the overall trajectory of our administration with Joe Biden. So my question for you is, having worked with, you know, the Democratic senatorial campaign in 2010, winning those seats for Democrats, keeping that majority, even with the representatives, how the representatives having a high Republican turnout, how do you think Democrats can win this year big in Georgia?
Yeah, it's a great question. And I don't know if you two have seen, but I'm happy to talk about it now, and you should sort of circulate it to your audience. But there's been a few reports coming out that have come out since the November election that shows that young people really made a huge difference. That without sort of young voters being more engaged and charged in this campaign than they have been in previous cycles, it's not clear that Joe Biden would have won. And so we are seeing a boost in youth turnout across the board. And sometimes, you know, people in DC, we just think that that's sort of like California, New York, and sort of these metropolises that are urban. But the truth is, it looks like young people put Joe Biden over the top in Michigan and Wisconsin, and probably Pennsylvania too. So there's a lot of data to show that that you know, for better or for worse, we're sort of in your hands. Old people like myself were sort of grateful that, you know, people are sort of stepping up. And I think that broadcasts like this are one of the reasons why. And unfortunately, like, the job's not done, right? November 7th was just the November 4th was just the beginning. Obviously this election in Georgia is right around the corner. And I know that early vote has started, and, you know, making sure our people turn out is just the name of the game, that that we can win. There is a road to victory here, but it's just a matter of if our folks are mobilized, engaged, and organized. And obviously young people play a critical role in that, because A, you know, they have, not they, you all have the sort of capacity and the ability to sort of reach out to your own networks and mobilize people, and that historically young people in this country don't vote, right? Unfortunately, they just turn out,
right?
But older people do, and I think we started to sort of chip away at that problem in November, and you saw the results. And now, if we can just like keep it up, I think that we could possibly win new seats in Georgia, and beyond that, right? That you know, staying engaged for the duration here, for the long haul, is going to be important. And I know that that's sort of what your message has been to your audience. And that's why I'm so glad you're doing this show, because, you know, once Joe Biden is elected, then the hard work begins, right?
Mm-hmm. Right.
Yeah.
Then we can't just sort of go home, but sort of the responsibility as citizen is not a light switch. It doesn't turn on and off.
Yeah.
And, I know I'm not here to plug President Obama's book, but if you take a look at his book, and if you've heard,
I love it. Yeah, we're both reading it right now, actually.
Good, good. I think you'll see that, you know, even in 2008 and 2009, right, there was a sort of national movement that was built to usher in new leadership and a person who, you know, had this fairly unusual and uncommon story into the White House.
Mm-hmm.
And that sort of grassroots energy was, again, I know you guys were young at the time, but it was pretty fascinating, and it was scintillating, and it was electric, right? You could sort of feel that around the country. But once President Obama got into office, a lot of that energy dissipated, and his ability to sort of get his agenda through Congress met with fierce resistance.
Mm-hmm.
And sort of people sort of resorted back to like not caring about politics and government. And I think what we've seen in the past few years, which is people actually caring, right? If you go back to January 2017, you know, the women's marches in Washington and around the country. If you go back to the debate over repealing the ACA, right, people sort of lit up the Capitol Hill switchboards and went to town halls. The March for Our Lives, led by the students from Parkland. All of these moments, and then, of course, you know, this past summer with the racial justice protests, and then obviously the capstone would be record turnout in November, that we have, that our people are awake, right? And that people are starting to grasp that not only what the stakes are, but that everyone sort of can play a role, and that government isn't a foreign thing. It's not us versus them. It is for and by the people.
Absolutely.
And
I think
more and more people who realize that can sort of provide the connective tissue between what issues that you care about, whether it's climate, whether it's healthcare, whether it's jobs, economy, technology, whatever it is, racial justice, criminal justice, social equality, whatever sort of issue animates you, there's not a disconnect between that and what's happening in Washington. Like, mm-hmm. you are the connector, in that, in appreciating the role that you can play is sort of the secret sauce here, I think.
Absolutely. And I think that it's something that we hear a lot, obviously being youth in politics. You always hear when you're talking to, or at least when we're talking to our peers, it's politics aren't really for me. I can't even vote yet. It's not that important. And obviously, me and Varun cannot vote. We can vote in 2 years here, but being educated about politics is just as important as voting. And although we can't vote, we can go out and protest and we can go out and demonstrate and we can knock on doors for our political representatives that we believe best represent us. And something big that the youth is getting behind is social media. Mm-hmm. And I know that a lot of, especially here, John Ossoff has been using TikTok extremely effectively. And the people that are organizing these social media drives and campaigns are not people, you know, the old older generations. They are 18, 19, 20 year olds, you know, people in college or just out of college. So what importance and how important is this kind of wave of social media? Obviously, we saw the president of the United States, President Donald Trump, be one of the most active presidents on Twitter, for better or for worse. I think we can all agree for worse. But what is the importance of social media in this age?
Yeah, I think it's hugely important. And you know, setting an example that, like you said, it's not only, you know, sort of cool to be engaged in politics, but it's necessary. Mm-hmm. And, you know, a lot of people are busy and young people are busy too. High schoolers have a lot to do. And especially right now that there's just a lot of cross currents and competing pressures and, you know, it's a real challenging time. But being as visible as you can be, that you are engaged and here are the stakes and here's why you should be too, is important. I know the Biden campaign had a really robust sort of high school outreach program, where, you know, they understood that, like you said, a lot of high schoolers can't vote, but they can be the foot soldiers. Yep. And whether you're phone banking, whether you are going door to door, sometimes it's just talking to your parents, talking to your parents' friends. Sometimes it's, you know, what's happening in your church or your synagogue or, you know, so whatever your sort of social network is, it's important to tap that. You know, for example, you know, we can't compete with, you know, President Trump's war chest or his social network or Fox News or sort of the right-wing media ecosystem. But it is also true that there are more of us than there are of them.
Yes. Yeah.
Right. Absolutely.
Who enjoy our vision of an inclusive country, than the other side. And if all of us just sort of use our networks to spread the word, and to engage, then that's how we win.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah.
Absolutely. And, you know, I went out with friends and knocked on doors to get, you know, Warnock and Ossoff and Joe Biden the election this year. And when I saw Georgia flip blue, I can't even tell you how excited I was because we contributed to that change. And I think that it's important to keep getting that grassroots energy up. I think that Obama talks about it a lot in his book, Promised Land. He talks about how his campaign kind of worked with grassroots energy. They were the campaign of getting out volunteers instead of getting out big voting drives because those volunteers went out and got more votes. I think that's the vision that we have to perpetuate in the Democratic Party. It's a really strong point. And I think that, you know, the book is amazing, first of all, but your role with Designated Survivor, I'm a big fan of the TV show.
Yeah.
I've been watching it for quite a while. I will tell you, I went off to House of Cards in the middle there, but I came back to it very recently. And you speak a lot about the realities of politics in that show. It kind of shows in your season, which you came in, the realities of politics are really shown and they become exuberant. So what do you think is the reality of politics that, you know, doesn't make it that, that, like you said before, when Obama became president, people stopped thinking of him as a celebrity. What are the realities of politics that make it so, I don't want to say boring, but a little bit more bland than the campaign?
Yeah, I mean, look, governing is hard. and it's not always pretty.
Yeah.
Right.
But I think the key is to connect it with the aspirational sentiments that you see on the campaign trail. And so as much as these candidates motivate you and the issues animate you and you want to make progress on, you know, either an issue or an area that is important to you. We can't just send people to Washington and wish them well, right? Stay on them. And if the people you oppose got elected, you've got to keep up the pressure and, you know, hold them accountable. And so whether that's, like you said, phone banking, hitting the streets, writing into their offices, whatever you can do to sort of stay active and keep the pressure on is the only way this government's going to work. Because obviously, you know, there's nothing more important than voting. And again, we're starting to see more people do it. And that is, you know, profoundly important to make sure democracy works. But if you sort of cast your ballot and then we don't hear from you for 4 years, you're sort of letting everyone off the hook, right?
Yeah. Like, yeah.
You need to cast your ballot, but that's just the beginning. And I think, again, providing the resources and the engagement so that you are continuing to stay on those who you elected is really important. And, you know, there's obviously off-year elections. There's work to be done at the grassroots level, whether you want to pick up a seat or defend a seat. And again, in sort of so many of these campaigns, in my experience in politics, which is sort of people your age are the ones powering them, right? Like,
yeah.
You know, it may not feel like it, but high schoolers probably have more discretionary time than, you know, adults who have jobs and kids and parents to take care of. And so the fact that, like, if you could give a few hours a week, you know, after school or something and help a campaign, you're going to get a ton of bang for the buck there because we just need the help, right? There's just so much work to go around.
Absolutely. And so I guess this is bringing a perspective on, I guess, the Democratic policy or the Democratic Party's kind of perspective on how to campaign properly and effectively. And something that you brought up earlier was the Fox News and the Fox Newses of the world, I guess, and the different right-leaning or right-winged, frankly, media agencies. And something that we've noticed here in being a leftist media agency is that there's not as much of an allegiance. Obviously, we try to stay centrist in our policies, but being young and being advocates, we tend to say things that tend to align with the Democratic Party. But one thing that we have noticed is that there's not sort of this unity and unification even within the Democratic Party, whether that be in media, or we even see that with the, you know, President-elect Joe Biden right now, where there's this tension between the far left of the party and the left of the party and the center left. So what are these steps in making sure that that we can all get behind one message?
Yeah. I mean, welcome to the Democratic Party, right?
yeah. Tell us about it. Yeah.
If you want to work in politics and you want easy street, like, run away from our party.
Yeah.
You know, but obviously that's what makes it sort of wonderful and inclusive and we're a rowdy bunch. And we're not gonna just, you know, like you said, like, a lot of people thought of Barack Obama as this sort of celebrity figure in 2008 and 2009, sort of larger than life. But listen, some of our fiercest critics when we were in the White House came from the left, right? Like,
yes, yeah.
Loud, progressive liberals who were very hard on Obama. A lot of them went on MSNBC. And, you know, we have made the point that, you know, it's not analogous. What you're saying is true, which is the right wing and the left wing media are not analogous, are not equivalent. you know, we know that despite the depravity of the Trump administration and what this White House has done, Fox News has his back every step of the way.
Yes. Like, yes.
There's nothing that will deter Fox from protecting President Trump, even when he does, you know, despite the rampant corruption, the catastrophic response to this pandemic, and any other sort of way that he's thrown out is some of the sort of traditional Democratic norms.
Yes. Yeah.
On the other hand, you know, President Obama was susceptible to plenty of criticism from left, right, and center. And so I don't think the answer is to tell the left or you know, sort of left-leaning progressive media to just go along. I think you guys, if you're speaking from a media platform, I think you all should hold Joe Biden accountable, right? Like, I don't think you should just turn into shills for the administration no matter what he does.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Process only works if you're tough on him. Yep. And so I think that being active and aggressive and sort of staying on it is far better than just sort of like hands off, shilling, whatever he says goes. I think where this gets complicated is, you know, Biden was elected president, not czar. And so he cannot wave a magic wand and operationalize everything that we all would want. And so he is going to face constraints. And, you know, unless we pick up both Georgia seats, you know, a Republican Senate. And so I think sort of pushing and advocating is something that's important for you all to do, but it's also important to explain and to help your audience and your followers understand how governing works. And I'm glad you're reading the book, because there's a lot in President Obama's book that talks about this, that sort of what the realities are, what the realities that Obama faced, but that Joe Biden will face as president. And sort of walking through how it actually works. Because I fear that when, after 100 days or a year, what have you, of Joe Biden's presidency, you know, all the problems are not going to go away, right? I'm convinced that we will make progress, but it's not going to be enough that people think that we got rid of Trump and now it's sunshine and roses. And so part of this is educating people who aren't necessarily sort of involved in the day-to-day of politics that sort of, if we are moving the needle in the right direction, then that is worth it, right? And so sometimes you can't have the full loaf, but you've got to take a few slices. And I think that sort of that frustration is something that, you know, we're going to have to be mindful of over the next few years.
Yeah. And, you know, it's absolutely true. People were celebrating a couple of my friends were celebrating after Joe Biden won, saying, COVID's done. I can go out again. But that is going to take a lot of stuff to do. You know, first of all, Joe Biden doesn't go into office until January 20th of the inauguration. But second of all, it's going to take a long road ahead to get rid of this pandemic. But beyond that, you know, me and Damian and our conservative correspondents on the podcast have talked a lot about, you know, holding Joe Biden accountable. And we came to the decision that, you know, if we don't hold the president accountable, we are not holding ourselves accountable. And that as a media source, it's important for us to say we have to give scrutiny to every single public official, be that source of critique. And that's, you know, that's holding us accountable. But beyond that, I wanted to talk to you about, you know, what young teens have been kind of perpetuating continuously. And that's the idea that slogans like defund the police are things that should be spread on social media a lot. And there's very conflicting opinions about these. But most recently, President Obama came out on Snapchat, I believe, a platform that I use. And he talked about how defunding the police may be killing the Democratic Party, not the words that he used, but kind of the gist of what he's saying and what social media interpreted him as. But what do you think about these slogans like defund the police and these ideas that progressives kind of put out? And that's obviously a big conservative talking point, attacking point. But what do you think they do for the Democratic Party? Are they good in terms of us winning elections, or do they kind of hinder our progress going forward towards bipartisan change?
Yeah, so I think this is a good question, and it's a sort of a healthy discussion to have. I think that you know, the Democratic Party is going to be most effective and most successful when we are as inclusive as possible and when we are widening the sort of aperture as far as we can. And so our hope is that people are tuning in and that we're not doing anything inadvertently to tune people out. And I, President Obama has said several times, and obviously I agree with him, that if you look at what Black Lives Matter has accomplished in the last few years, it's tremendous, right? They are, that group is a case study in grassroots organizing and telling a story, in making sure that they have sort of captivated the attention of the country.
Absolutely.
And you know, that is sort of they are a playbook. What that group has accomplished, even though their leaders aren't necessarily household names. But the message that they push, the story that they've told, again, in the middle of a pandemic when we were all being told to stay home, people wanted to rush to the streets to push their cause. And if you look at the pictures of the people who were in those protests, you know, it wasn't all people of color, right? Plenty of white people, plenty of old people, plenty of young people, all different sort of persuasions. And I think that's what gave a lot of us who are sort of, you know, political professionals hope, right? That people beyond the sort of usual suspects, the usual sort of activists in that space were getting involved. And again, we're hitting the streets and we're making their voice heard. And so I do think that groups like Black Lives Matter have sort of written a playbook for the rest of us to follow in terms of how to make a difference. I also think, by the way, there's a difference between what the role of activists like a Black Lives Matter, the role of media like your show, the role of elected officials, right? Not everyone is going to sort of have the same posture in that debate, that it is the role of the activist to sort of push an agenda. It's the role of the media to sort of suss that out and discuss it and sort of figure out what's happening on the ground and if that is disconnected from what's happening amongst policymakers. And then it's the role of the elected officials to make decisions that reflect the will of the people. And not to go back to your earlier point, but you know, that's why voting and staying involved is so important, because if they're not hearing from you, they're definitely hearing from the other side.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely. And it all does come back around full circle to voting and to being involved in politics. And they're definitely going to be hearing from the other side. If there's a grievance to be had, if there's not a grievance to be had and someone's doing a good job, then there's a grievance to be had elsewhere. And people are going to always advocate that. And unfortunately, we only reserve 30 minutes with Eric, and we can imagine that you're extremely busy. But I do want to ask you one final question that we ask all of our guests. And that is, if you had one message, one quote, one thing, one saying that you could leave to America's youth today, what would it be?
Oh God, why didn't you give me a heads up on this?
We never give, we do not give our guests heads up on it because we want it to be straight from the heart. We had Jason Bogsky the other day on the podcast, and he took 4 minutes to answer this question. So take your time.
Yeah.
We can deal with it in post. Do not worry about it.
Yeah. And look, people are always thrown off by it.
Can you ask me one more time?
Yeah. If you had just one saying, one message, one thing, one quote that you could leave to America's youth, what would it be?
Yeah, I think I am going to just quote President Obama from his farewell address, which is, if you don't like what's happening in government, grab a clipboard and get involved.
Absolutely.
Government is not something that's an us versus them thing. It's an us thing. And the only people who have the power to change it are all of us. And whether you want to run for office, whether you have a candidate you support, whether you just have an issue that you feel like needs special attention, don't rely on the rest of us to address it. Get off the couch, get off your phone, and let's do something about it.
Absolutely. And with that being said, ladies and gentlemen, we're going to cut to a quick ad break, and me and Varun will pick up with some commentary afterwards. Thank you, guys. All right, we're back from our ad break. Man, that was a really good episode.
Yeah, I mean, absolutely. With my mic, it would have been better. But
you want to talk about the mic issues?
we should talk about it. You know, since we're being transparent and since we're being, you know, free with what we have to say, my issue was my microphone wasn't turned up. Its volume wasn't turned up, so I just had to click a button, and I would have been fine. But unfortunately, I, being the numbskull that I am, did not turn the volume up. So this is what we're in. But it's okay. We're back now, and for you guys. I have my volume. We're able to, you know, talk freely about what happened during the podcast. I think it went amazingly.
Yeah.
I mean, I think we both agree on that. It was an amazing episode. You know, amazing interview with Eric Schultz, a person that we both respect and look up to. You know, when he talked about his poli sci degree from Washington University, I know it was a small segment. He talked about that, but it was amazing because me, I've been told my entire life, poli sci degree doesn't mean anything. It's meaningless. It won't get you a job. And that's what I've been, you know, led to believe my entire life by family and friends. And so hearing a guy so successful, a person so successful with that degree was very inspiring to me, especially. I think it's inspiring to a lot of people. His story from the ground up and his role with Obama. We didn't even ask him about, you know, his role with President Obama, which is probably the most interesting thing that could have come out. But things happened, and it was an amazing episode.
I was
blown away by how we got that guest and how much, you know, we talked to him and had the conversation with him.
Yeah, absolutely. And the thing is, like, I wish we could have done that for an hour. Like, that was a really good conversation, and there was so much more to talk about. Like, afterwards, we talked about the Schultz group and just different. I mean, we always talk with our guests usually 5 to 10 minutes. Sometimes I remember speaking of, I butchered Jason's name, so I'm sorry, Jason. Jason Bosky. After we had him on the podcast, like we talked to him for like another 2 hours. So sometimes recording, we'll talk with our guests for a while. We talked to Eric for like 5 minutes afterwards, and we were talking about the Schultz group, which is this small business that he has, which basically gets you like connections in Washington. And for anyone that's, I guess, an aspiring politician, I think it serves well with media and stuff. He works, you know, behind the scenes to get you connections. I know that he also does it for like stock investors and stuff, to just, I guess, be more informed in the stock world. So I mean, it was just awesome, and it was awesome to be able to talk about him. And you mentioned the whole Obama thing. This guy literally works with Obama, like with him, not necessarily in the sense of for him, but he works with Obama and he advises him, which is crazy. Like, we're literally one seat away from the president of the United States, and in the Oval Office, we were talking about before the podcast, this guy like was in the Oval Office almost every day, probably. And he was speaking to Obama almost every day, and now I'm assuming he is speaking to Obama every day and being a senior advisor to him. So it's crazy how close, because I mean, let's be honest here, right? There's like not a hierarchy. There's like a pecking order. I don't know the proper terminology for it, but in being a podcast about politics, there's certain people that you want to have on the podcast, and I think Obama is like the top of that. I don't care if you're a Republican podcast. I don't care if you're a Democratic podcast. If you're just talking about sheer pull and popularity and just like badassness, it's Obama. Like, Obama's the guy that you want to have that conversation with. So being that close to the president or former president of the United States, it's really cool and it's really inspiring. And it shows how, even though, I mean, both of us are 16 years old, how, really just working hard and trying things and emailing and phone calls, you know, I think that phone banking gets a bad rap as being ineffective. Trust me, I think this podcast is proof that writing emails and sending phone calls works.
Yeah. And, you know, George is proof that writing emails and sending calls, you know, worded that wrong, but you know, sending emails and making phone calls does work. Georgia was, as Eric Schultz and I both talked about, and Damien too, it's totally grassroots, right? You won here just because of volunteers coming out, almost like Obama got back in 2008. Democrats have won elections historically based upon grassroots movements, but as we read in Obama's book, A Promised Land, he focused more upon, and as I said in the interview, he focused more upon getting those volunteers as opposed to, you know, getting those voters. But eventually getting volunteers proved to him more valuable because those volunteers went out and set up shop in many places across the nation, made their own groups, got voters in their own right. So I think it was a very good and effective, you know, Democratic approach, a campaign approach. And I think that one of the biggest things that Eric Schultz mentioned on his interview was, you know, a democracy of, for, and by the people. And he used that quote. And I think that what we have to take in is the fact that today bipartisanship is very scarce. You find a bipartisan person, 1 in 1,000. It's a very scarce commodity in Washington. And it always has been, but now it's even more exacerbated. I think that, you know, we in the podcast, we strive to bring issues onto the forefront. It's not necessarily about being left or right. It's about presenting the issues. And I think that by doing that and by venturing into what issues you are passionate about, as opposed to Trump or Biden or Obama or Hillary Clinton or Marco Rubio, for that matter, five people who, by the way, came off the top of my mind. No, you know, no reference there. But it's about looking at the issues and evaluating those issues, and that gets you to that level of, you know, dropping that label and voting for who you think is best fit to continue those issues. And I think that once you focus upon being issue oriented, you'll become a very politically, I guess, a politically knowledgeable, a politically adept person, and that's what we try to, you know, perpetuate in kids across the nation. But, you know, you guys go out, make your own groups. One last thing about Obama in the book, you know, we were reading it, and as I was reading it yesterday at like 2:00 a.m. or something, I was reading about how Obama in Iowa, he didn't put out volunteers because he didn't feel like it was necessary, but he got an Iowans for Obama group that's already, you know, that was set up there, and he used them as a vessel to get more voters. And I think that when you organize for action, like we are doing, that's Obama's term, by the way, organizing for action. When you organize for action, like Polititeen is doing, like many groups across the nation, like High School Democrats, which I coach here in Georgia, is doing, we can really see results. And so, you know, as my, you know, kind of call to action, it's go out and first of all, look at the issues. And second of all, fight for those issues with pen and paper, like Eric Schultz said.
Yeah, and like a bunch of different groups are doing. I don't know why you were mentioning High School Democrats and stuff, and I instantly thought of Turning Point USA on the conservative side. You know, with all these issues, the Turning Point USA, it just sparked the idea of just listen. Again, we're trying to be centrist here on the, or I try to be centrist here on the podcast. Obviously, some of you have brought some of my socialist tendencies and claims especially with the last episode into the spotlight. I'm already being called a socialist right away. I'm not yet a self-proclaimed socialist, but I have been listening to these different socialist points of views. Are you familiar with Turning Point USA?
I am. I'm familiar with Charlie Kirk, who is kind of their head. Yeah.
Yeah. First of all, just Charlie Kirk, like, do we want to go there?
I don't know if he deserves a mention on our podcast. I mean, you can talk all you want about Charlie Kirk, but I think that one night at RNC showed you what he was capable of. It's literally like William Barr was doing. You see him writing love letters to Trump, but they're not love letters.
Oh my God, we need to talk about that.
And so just a quick reference. You know, love letters and Trump have been, you know, notoriously popular. You saw Kim Jong-un going out and sending those love letters, and Barr doubling up, the Attorney General of the United States, William Barr, sending those same love letters. I think there might be one from Barr to Kim Jong-un in the future, but, you know, we can never tell. That's what has been happening. That was his resignation letter is what I'm referring to. It was a suck up, and I think that he doesn't deserve, you know, that much discussion, but it definitely was a sight to see.
Definitely. And oh, so one thing that I want to talk about with, at least with Charlie Kirk, is like, it's interesting because we were talking with Eric, in the previous segment, and we were talking about how, I mean, if you're on the right, and you do something, like, you'll be on Fox News the next day. Like, I'm not even kidding. If our podcast was conservative and we were having conservative guests on, we would be on Fox News, I think, at this point. Like, we would have been interviewed at least by a local Fox News conservative network or some you know, right-leaning media source. But the left isn't as good as that, and I think Charlie Kirk is the best example of that. I mean, and just the activism that he's done with Turning Point USA and how that propelled him into like this national spotlight. I mean, the right is just so good at doing that, and I think it's something that we struggle with on the left. Obviously, I guess the issue is that we try to not be, or we, look at me, man, the centrist claim. On the left, I suppose we, right, as we're going to discuss here in a second.
Welcome to the left, Danny.
Just for now, I'm just it's a quick visit. It's a quick visit. We'll see how long I stay. It's just a hotel room. Maybe I'll buy a condo around the area. But we'll talk about that in a second. We on the left, with my what do I have? I have a visa. I'm just a temporary worker here, but claim that don't present this unified front, especially in the media. And I think that Politine is a big aspect of that, and a big representation of that, rather, because I mean, obviously, the right's just really good at putting on this front, and I think that something that has become an issue in right wing politics is this idea of these love letters and frankly, you know, kissing the president's behind. And I talked about it, and I think I talked about it on the last podcast, if I'm not mistaken, or the podcast maybe even before that, where I mentioned, you know, Federalist 10 and Madison's approach with factions and stuff. And the issue is that Donald Trump has just become a hero, kind of like a god, and like nothing that he does can be wrong. And the right-wing media continually propels that. And it's very odd because, you know, for people that consider themselves conservatives, it's really weird how they can change with the press of one tweet, right? If Donald Trump came out and tweeted, "I am now pro-choice," you know, everyone would be like, "Well, yeah, we always have been pro-choice. That's the conservative platform. We've always in the Bible it says that that God gives us free will and we abide by that." But do we want to talk about the love letters? Genuinely, I don't get mad, right? And I use some very vulgar terms on my private private social media platforms when referring to Bill Barr's former Attorney General Bill Barr's love letters to. I mean, it was just, listen, I'm gonna try again to not use the same words, definitely, that I used in private. But like, but man, just how much of a loser do you have to be to write that? Like, you're on your way out. At least leave with some decency and dignity. Like, he's the definition. Like, I know we use, as a society, we overuse the term loser, so it's lost its meaning. But he's the textbook definition, the Webster dictionary definition of a loser.
I mean, yeah, there's truth in that, but I think it's old news. I mean, we've known this for a long time. I think that his love letters are kind of obsolete now, talking about what's happening today. I mean, there's so much that have been happening ever since Bill Barr announced his resignation, or rather Trump announced his resignation via Twitter. You know, there's a lot that happened. And I think that, you know, it's important to recognize that today, Mitch McConnell, and yesterday, obviously, the electors voted for Joe Biden, as expected, as president. One of our previous guests in the podcast, Nikhem Williams, was one of the electors for Georgia, which we're proud to say that happened. You know, kudos to you, Nikhema. But they voted Joe Biden in as president, and they reflected the American people's votes in the general election. And I think that something to take away there is that Mitch McConnell came out today and told the American people that Joe Biden is the rightful president-elect. The voters have spoken, and that he was willing to recognize Joe Biden as that president-elect. And I think that, you know, by saying so, there's a big example that was set to the rest of the Republican Party, a big, you know, F you almost to people like the House Minority Leader. I'm forgetting his name, Kevin McCarthy, the House Minority Leader, and the 100 other Republicans who signed on to basically the whole Republican representative caucus. They signed on to the amicus curiae brief saying the election was rigged and that widespread voter fraud did happen. But I think that when you talk about things like this, and the whole reason, guys, and the whole reason for why AG Bill Barr did resign, I believe, in my opinion, and in many people's opinion, was the fact that he did say that the election was fair, and that there was no widespread voter fraud. And that really is the reason for why that happened. And so when you talk about it, you also have to give claim and give credence to what happened today with Mitch McConnell. And also beyond that, as a, you know, daily news briefing, we had Pete Buttigieg funneled in as Joe Biden's nomination for the transportation secretary, a person that I've loved. I have raved to Damien about how good he is at speaking, almost comparable to President Obama, who was that celebrity kind of figure. And that is an amazing, amazing thing for democracy today. But as Eric said, it's a long road ahead. And I think that by making good picks, by, you know, continuing to not doubt democracy, we can see that road much more closely. And I think that we're working towards more bipartisan change here at, you know, Politine as well. We're going to have two conservatives on the podcast. Number one,
finally,
Tina Barton, hopefully. Finally, absolutely. Yeah. Beyond Will and Brad, we've been kind of confined to conservatives, and Patrick for one episode. But we're going to have Tina Barton,
one of the first city clerks who did confirm the election and say there was no widespread voter fraud, a Republican in her own right. And also one of our, you know, local state representatives from Georgia is going to come on next Monday for a podcast with us. But bipartisanship, again, is about issues and fundamentally, you know, defining those. But I want to talk about this whole socialism discussion because we've been holding it in for a while now. And I wanted to give you a pulpit, if you'd like it, to talk about that, and we can kind of go back and forth for a couple of minutes here.
Yeah, so we should just adapt communism, like, period. No, I'm completely kidding. But but
scare for a minute, Damien. Scare me for a minute.
The Communist Manifesto, I think, should just be our new, the Communist Manifesto should just be our new constitution. We should just go with that. I think that there's been, this is something that happens, and we talked about it a little bit with Eric about, like, defund the police and the terms that we use as a society. I think the United States uses really rugged terms, and we have, like, negative connotation and positive connotation, like, at all times. Like, now kneeling has, like, this negative connotation where it's like, oh, well, you hate the flag if you kneel for the national anthem. How dare you go against everything? Whereas, like, before, kneeling was, like, a sign of respect. So who knows where this is going to go? But socialism as a whole, I'm using a more European definition of it. I was speaking to Varun about democratic socialism. Apparently, that's not socialism. But as many of you have known, I mean, for the past, 58 episodes? We're on 59 today?
Yep.
For the past 58 episodes, I have been Damien Centrist Galvin. I've always tried to keep that center approach. But honestly, I'm just seeing a lot more, and I can't imagine the conservatives are going to come for me after this. The liberals and the leftists are just going to be so ecstatic to hear this. But I'm starting to see a lot of logical fallacies in conservative arguments. And I don't know if necessarily the answer is socialism. Particularly, obviously, we can have that discussion, but I'm just seeing a lot of logical fallacies in conservative arguments, and it's starting to drive me away from it. And I think that a lot of execution of these policies requires a lot of execution of even semi left leaning ish left centrist policies require implementation. Wow, one word that I've just struggled to say on the podcast. Again, execution is the word that I'll resort to, of some right-wing policies. And I think that we can't settle as a generation that wants to see climate change disappear. You know, the existential threat to our generation is climate change. That I want to see, you know, I don't want racism to be an issue. I don't want systemic racism to be an issue. And so when I'm sitting here on the center line and I'm saying, yeah, I'm centrist, that means that it's just, I cannot be centrist on an issue of the environment because the group sitting right next to me, if I'm sitting in the middle, is saying that the existential threat that is climate change is not important or is not as critical as I believe it to be. And it is critical. I can't be centrist and be sitting next to someone on my right that's saying that systemic racism is just not real. I think that the jump off the cliff, you know, from the right to the left, if you go to the left, There's a little bit more leniency, a little bit more buoyancy, I suppose. But if you go to the right, it's just a cliff. You know, systemic racism just isn't real. And I cannot believe that. Free market capitalism is something that I think we can discuss, and we can discuss the benefits of it and the its shortcomings, especially. I think that capitalism, many aspects of capitalism need to be revitalized or not necessarily revitalized, but readjusted at the very least. I think that capitalism is becoming the new feudalism. And that it's just becoming an outdated method that's not going to be able to support our society. And I think that we're seeing that come more and more apparent as we see economic recession after economic recession after economic recession. Almost every 10 years is what it feels like. But we can talk about that in a second. I'm just talking about why, in general, I'm starting to lean towards more leftist policies. And I love someone to come on the podcast and disagree with me. But the thing is, like, I've just been trying to get behind some conservative arguments. And I want to start by saying the reason the way that this came to be was Varun is a leftist. And so I started looking at right arguments because I was like, you know what, maybe I can become conservative. maybe I'll become conservative for the sake of the podcast and I'll kind of endeavor into these ideas and get a good understanding of them. And as I started reading this, I was just like, it was this article about how redlining isn't real. I was like, that's not true. Like, redlining is it's a systemic issue that has caused African Americans to be not only disenfranchised but undereducated and has caused violence and gangs and stuff, which we try to solve with things like the war on drugs, which was blatantly, you know, a conservative standpoint, and the Republican Party has apologized for as being racist. It was literally targeted towards African Americans, and if you deny that, which a lot of conservatives do, then you're just blind. Honestly, you're just a blind follower, because the Republican Party itself has come out and formally apologized for the war on drugs. But yeah, that's how I became a leftist by trying to become a rightist. So take that as you will, Varun. You can enjoy that.
Yeah. And personally for me, I've always been, I believe myself to be very much of a centrist, but I call myself leftist because some of my ideas are leftist. My thing is, like, it takes a lot to be completely down the line and to, in today's atmosphere, to be completely centrist. But for all practical purposes, I try to not be too left. I am a moderate leftist. So it's a good contrast to have, especially today when we're talking about socialism. But yeah, on the topic of being centrist and just being down the center, I just haven't met a single person in my entire life who's been down the center. And I think that is a good statement to say, just how hard and how difficult and how scarce it is to find someone who is down the center, because, you know, today you see people on both sides. I'm saying on both sides because it happens on both sides, talking about the things, like you said, that are false, and they're saying they're true, and they're saying presumptively that they have credence. And so there is a very strong divide between parties that makes it hard for people to be centrist. But, you know, on things like climate change, I think there are two solutions. There is the conservative solution and there is the democratic solution. But I think we should emphasize the fact that there are two solutions. What the Republican Party is saying right now is that there is no solution that is imminent, that is needed, or is necessary. So when we're talking about climate change, throw out the conservatives right now. Because in the spirit of what we talked about with I believe, William Hughes, one of our previous guests, start talking about solutions. Stop talking about things that people are denying, things that people are denying needs importance when you know it to be true. Let's stop talking about the conservative solution. Let's talk about the GOP, solution. Let's talk about the actual rudimentary conservative solution, the capitalist solution, economically. And I believe in it. The way to solve it, and I've been talking about it for a while, is a carbon tax. And that basically incentivizes businesses, takes things away if they burn too much carbon, if they emit carbon emissions, and incentivizes them for reducing their impact upon the environment, and it gives them economic gain. You saw it work back when Obama was president. Obama instituted tax breaks for people who did buy a Nissan Leaf, an EV. Think about how many EVs were on the road during that time. Mm-hmm. I think it's all a game of economic balancing. Yeah. And so that's the capitalist approach. And I think that when you talk about that, instead of saying, well, it deserves no credit, that then you can really morph into change. Now, the problem is there is two forms of capitalism. There is laissez-faire capitalism and there is regulated capitalism. I think that if you regulate capitalism and use it to your benefit, then it can achieve really strong results. And that's a great example of it. When you use it for a carbon tax, when you create a whole carbon-centric economy, which is a push and pull with how much money you are making and losing based upon your environmental impact, that is what capitalism can be used as, in my opinion. And so I am very, very much a capitalist. I'm also very much a Democrat. And there is a middle line for both of those things. And that's my centrist approach to climate change. And I think that there's multiple definitions of centrism. Yeah. Most of y'all probably won't agree that's centrist. It for all practical purposes, it probably isn't centrist.
Yeah.
But that is my approach because it incorporates
The issue with that, Varun, is that it's to the right, it's just socialist. You want to tax us? That's socialism. And I don't mean that as a straw man argument. I think the right does. The right, literally, just any, because you have to understand that both of these things, and we were talking about this before I think it was earlier today when we were preparing for this podcast, but socialism is a spectrum, capitalism is a spectrum, literally free market and regulated market is a spectrum. Like all of these policy, I mean, being a Republican and being a Democrat is a spectrum. And so if there is anything that even leans on the spectrum of socialism, then it is instantly considered, you know, deemed socialist. I mean, how many times have we seen Tucker Carlson just come on and be like, AOC and Bernie Sanders are socialists? Like, and you're a racist, my guy. Like, what's the problem? Like, what's the... It just doesn't make sense. Like, one of these is blatantly true. Like, you are racist. Like, Tucker Carlson is racist, and he's I think genuinely, right? I've been trying to listen to Tucker Carlson, and every time that I pull away, I don't go, oh man, this guy has a good argument, or you know what, he kind of has a point there. I just go, this guy's an idiot. He's racist, and he's honestly damaging what it means to be an American and what it means to be a patriot, more so than even socialist policies, were they to be true and truly implemented in the United States of America, the thing is that, you know, the carbon tax that you're talking about, that's socialist, Varun. Like, you know, by the right standards, that's socialist. Right. And that's, I guess that's where I'm starting to see, more so than deeming myself a socialist by the right standard. I'm just saying, you know what, if you guys are going to think that I'm socialist, I'm going to take in the name. I'm going to take it in. But honestly, the free market approach that the right wants is just not, it's not true. I was, you know, speaking of Charlie Kirk, I was watching him debate, and he was talking about how, I mean, the whole point of Turning Point USA is the fact that there's a lack of representation on college campuses for Republicans or for conservatives, rather. And one thing that he said is he like completely destroyed his own argument. He was saying the reason that. Or he's basically crying that conservatives don't get enough representation in on college campuses, and then he says the reason that we don't go to college is because we have our names on the building, and going to college is a more liberal, you know, academia is a more liberal route, whereas we're the business owners that have our names on building. And my response to that was like, okay, then why are you crying about not having representation in college if you're yourself admitting that you don't go to college because you're apparently a badass that puts your name on the side of a plane. And my complaint has just been, Varun, that I don't think that every solution to a problem is to make a new business. You know, because that's what the free market approach is. If you have a problem, you make a business to resolve around it. I had a question for you. Why are businesses always created in times of desperation? Like, how come right now Jeff Bezos and all these multi-billionaires, instead of hurting in the pandemic like millions and millions, like 40 million Americans did, why did they become more wealthy?
I think it's because, you know, they began, think about their position in life. They created Amazon and companies like this, like Zoom and Amazon went up with the pandemic. Some companies went down. It is that push and pull movement. But I think that they provide a service to the people, and I don't think that honestly, it's just the fact that they created businesses that were suited for that. And I think that it's false to say that they capitalized and they created the pandemic or something based upon the idea that they would capitalize upon it.
Yeah,
yes, that's they not capitalized true. Because they were in that situation.
Yeah, that's
and
that's
so
not
it's
true.
It's they're in a market niche, mm-hmm. but. And they're in that market niche. Some companies aren't, and that's very true. The government should be giving support to those companies. That's also very true. But I think it's not Amazon's responsibility to give support to those businesses, number one, because they are employing millions and millions of people, like I told you before. Yeah. But I think that the solution to many of these things, first of all, talking about Tucker Carlson, you know, the fact of the matter is that more academics are liberal. And that's the idea, right? It's statistically proven that more people who go to college educated people are liberal, and that the idea behind that is that when you get educated, you start to understand what the government can and can't do, and so you see more liberals there. But I think that one of the biggest approaches when you talk about socialism is it's a buzzword. Number one, because you can attack socialists, and if you're a socialist and you have no idea what you're talking about, you're going to get yourself killed on Tucker Carlson. Because first of all, he'll turn off the mic immediately when you start speaking about something good.
Yeah, that's what they all
same
do.
Same with Ben Shapiro, because they can't really look
Crowder.
At you that way. Steven Crowder, same thing. Most of the commentators. But anyways, the point is that if you bring up something, and this is one of the main arguments, I campaigned for one of these this senator, U.S. Senate candidate in Michigan called Solomon Rajput.
Mm-hmm. Great guy. I remember, yeah.
talked to him for a very long time. Great guy. But during one of his meetings, he talked about how, well, the main promise behind socialism is the fact that we have the most money in the world and we should use that money. And the other argument that I saw in many sources of people who are, in my opinion, uneducated socialists is that you don't need an incentive to get production. The idea is that every single human...
I don't think that's the claim behind socialism. I feel like that's an issue. I feel like socialism...
That is the issue. I'm getting to that. Yeah. I'm getting to that. The issue is that we have people like that appearing on these shows, which does bring down the idea of socialism. Obviously, I'm very much a capitalist, but I think that socialism has some benefits, a lot of benefits. And there's good claims behind socialism. But when you present things like that, it does seem... just as a terrible approach, a dystopian approach, it's not good. But I think that if you start to move towards a regulated, you know, free market society, you'll see a lot of benefits. I think that when you talk about, you know, companies and businesses suffering and how Jeff Bezos made a lot of money, well, we can solve that issue. And the way we solve that issue, and I talked to you about this before earlier today, is by increasing the minimum wage and instituting those capitalist reforms. But the same idea goes for anything else. You know, with socialism, again, the same analogy I'm going to end on here. For the time being, the idea that if you go to school and there are no grades, everything is homogenized, you're not going to work for jack shit.
Yeah.
And I'll edit that out in post.
No, yeah,
you're not going to work. And so that's the idea behind what capitalism is. And of course, there are give and takes to either. But I think that capitalism is a good framework that we can imprint our socialist ideas or more socialist ideas, regulations upon.
You see, but that's where I disagree on what capitalism is. I don't think that capitalism incentivizes people to work harder. And this is the truth behind capitalism, right? If let's say this is what capitalism does. It says, hey, the highest grade that you can get is an 80. Now either go with it or we'll find someone else to take your spot in the school. Either you want to get an 80 and that's the highest you can get, or we'll find another student who is also desperate for an education and they'll get an 80. And it also says that the principal, I'll just equate this essentially. I'll go with one point at a time. But it says that the highest grade that you can get is an 80. All right, so if you don't get any, and just to be frank here, to put this, if we're going to use schools as our analogy, with an 80, you cannot, well, let's say 79, right? Because the 79 will be more reasonable. That's a C that rounds you at about a 2 GPA. With a 2 GPA, you cannot get into essentially any colleges. You cannot provide for your family. You cannot get any merit-based scholarships or any scholarships in general, unless you're just an astounding writer and find some outside source scholarships, but you can't find any government at least funded scholarships with a 2.0 GPA. And that's essentially what capitalism does. Capitalism says, hey, you know what? The minimum wage is $10. Now you can either work for my company at $10 or you can kick rocks and go work somewhere else. Right. And so when all the companies start coming together and again, there was this idea of the free market, right? That everyone's going to, everyone's going to essentially raise their, or the invisible hand where everyone's going to essentially raise their wages because they're going to want more and more workers. But that's just not true. Actually, on the contrary, and what we've seen with these recessions in the past 10, 20 years is that, it's good for corporations for people to be desperate for work. It actually benefits corporations when people are desperate for work. And you might be wondering why. Because when you have a lot of people desperate for work that can't provide food on the table, they're willing to work for minimum wage. They're willing to work for a lot less. And again, I brought this example with Jeff Bezos. Jeff Bezos, I think he makes like a $324 million per hour. It would take what? I think the comparison was it would take the average worker 45 years to make what Jeff Bezos makes in an hour. You know, like how ridiculous that is. And I think that it's honestly more than 45 years, if I'm not mistaken. But do you mean to tell me that like Jeff Bezos is working per hour, right? If the federal minimum wage, or what's the average wage of an employee? Average
$7 is the minimum wage.
Average US wage. We'll go with the average US wage.
$7.
It's at the hourly. Let's go. Hourly. Yeah, the minimum wage, the federal minimum wage is $7. Okay, $20 per hour is the minimum wage. So Jeff Bezos is working at about, what, if you multiply 20 by some crazy number times harder than the average American worker. That's just not true. As a matter of fact, if Jeff Bezos were to die tomorrow, Amazon would be working effectively. But if all the workforce that works for Amazon were to die tomorrow, Amazon would actually be in shambles. And that's where you actually see a true stock market hit.
The idea is that, I mentioned this earlier, Jeff Bezos makes around $50,000 a year with his actual salary. Jeff Bezos doesn't make $45 billion or whatever he's worth. But then again, Jeff Bezos, kudos to him.
Yes, net worth is different. Let me start by saying that. Let me just backtrack. Okay. Net worth is not physical, like what you have physically in your bank account. I am aware of that. I'm not a dimwit.
Yeah, no, I got you. Yeah. My fault.
No. I just want to make that clear for the audience because some people will be like, he doesn't even know what net worth is. He thinks that Jeff Bezos is actually worth $174 billion.
Yeah, and I want to say is, you know, kudos to Jeff Bezos because he's made that money. He didn't begin making $45 billion. He began from the ground up. He began with a bookstore. I read Jeff Bezos' book. He came up there, and once he gets there, it's my opinion that he can do whatever the hell he wants with his money. Now, the way you help those workers at the very bottom is by regulation and making him and other entrepreneurs pay their workers more. And I think that is the most basic concept of it. And you have seen, yes, there is in some instances an invisible hand, but it's not in, if you talk about an invisible hand for the entire market, it's not nearly possible. I believe McDonald's, their CEO, if I'm not mistaken, one of the CEOs of the biggest companies during the recession, they gave away their salaries and a lot of their funds and their owner's draw to, you know, people under them to you know, get more employees in there, create more economic output and employ more people. And that's what people do in times of necessity in some situations. But I think that the way you help the workers out is by regulating the economy, by instituting democratic reforms, by, you know, increasing the minimum wage. But the same thing goes for example, if you had a completely homogenized society. And this is the way of thinking that I've subscribed to. Over the years, and it may change. Yeah. I don't know. I'm looking at Das Kapital. Don't read the Communist Manifesto. Don't read it. Read Das Kapital because the Communist Manifesto.
Read it if you can understand it. Read it if you can translate it correctly. It's a hard book. Manifesto, yeah, go for it.
All I'm saying is that book is not the best communist book to read to begin with.
It's definitely not.
I would say, in my opinion, Das Kapital is a better book to begin with because it gives you more substance behind it. The Manifesto is I've heard from friends. I have a lot of communist friends, socialist friends, my mistake. And they talk about how the book is basically fluff. It is very much propaganda. So look, read Das Kapital. That's one of the books that I recommend.
Yeah.
But beyond that, my capitalist standpoint is that if you homogenize, and I am in very much a democratic, I'm not going to call myself that. No, but capitalism.
Do it. Call yourself a democratic socialist.
No, I don't think I am. I think I agree with some regulations, but what they're proposing is beyond me. But my approach towards capitalism is the idea that if you homogenize society socially, like in a socialist way, you receive people who aren't willing to work past 2 weeks, right? When you homogenize society, you have no profit incentive, no incentive to upper yourself, level yourself up in society. There is no incentive to work for society, right? And what happens after that is you see people who are lazy on the streets doing whatever and making money while doing it and getting to eat while doing it. And what happens then is you see the government pushing back on it. And this is seen in many communist societies, many socialist areas. When people stop working, they get killed, they get whipped, and dictatorships happen. That's the number one issue with socialism. It's the idea that there's no incentive towards it. In a pure socialist society, there is no incentive.
Yeah,
and
but that, people are going that's to like, die. That's like people far-fetched communism, suffer. Though.
And that is socialism. Like if you're going to call yourself a socialist, that is socialism.
Well, the thing is now, that socialism
read,
is on a...
If you read Das Kapital or Communist Manifesto, that is socialism. And Karl Marx says it. And Communist Manifesto especially. Search up the quote. Karl Marx says something along the likes of, to institute this reform, people are going to suffer. People are going to die. It will have to happen. But let me talk about the second biggest issue with socialism. It's the idea that when you have a dictator in name, a person who runs a society, because you can't have a full government because that increases corruption chances. The only way to fully run a socialist society in the eyes of many philosophers and theorists is by having one central authority who is a true socialist. But what happens is after the first one, like Lenin or, for example, in Venezuela, I believe it was Hugo Chavez or something. But after that first person comes up, you see corruption happening, and it always happens. You see somebody becoming corrupt and becoming more of a dictatorship than it is a socialist society. So it's the line of succession, right? You have no true democracy in that society. And you can obviously institute that whatever you like. But the two biggest things is a lack of a profit incentive. And second of all, lack of a proper succession. But I think I'm going to stick with the idea that democratic socialism is far more appealing than socialism itself, because it plays upon the idea that you can have a fully functioning capitalist society while also being regulatory and instituting reforms. And I think that the two worst arguments that, in my opinion, are put out there is, number one, license for capitalism. That's screwed. And then number two, socialism, full-fledged socialism.
Yeah. Okay. Well, I just wanted to respond to the idea that, okay, socialism again is a spectrum. And if we're going to say that socialism is inherent, because there's always this discussion being made by the right that socialism is inherently evil, that would be like saying, and honestly, I genuinely believe that aspects of capitalism are inherently evil. And by and far, aspects of capitalism are inherently evil. As a matter of fact, capitalism, I genuinely believe, is a system in which promotes selfishness. And it does. It promotes selfishness. There's, you know, we talk about Jeff Bezos. Jeff Bezos could literally wake up tomorrow and decide to end world hunger. Obviously he doesn't choose to, but it's because he would lose. You know, he wouldn't get anything out of it.
You can't force somebody to do something.
I agree.
That is oppression.
I agree.
That's one thing I'm going
to
say. Yeah.
Well, it's oppression to force someone to feed the world, I suppose.
It is.
But
absolutely.
I mean, he'd be left with what? Oh no. Like he'd be left with, if he were to sell all of his Amazon stocks and decide to feed the whole world, he'd be left with $100 billion.
And look, it's not about agreeing with it.
Yeah.
It's not about agreeing with it. It's about what you can do and what you can't do, in my opinion.
What
somebody's personal property
absolutely.
Is and what it isn't.
Yeah, and I understand that. And I think that there needs to be a vast redistribution of wealth in the United States of America, because as I just said, he could literally wake up. And again, there's no incentive for him to do so. Second of all, there's no requirement for him to do so. I think that in a certain sense, I would like to think that he has a moral inclination to end world hunger, especially since he literally can. Like, this is not something that is far-fetched. He could end world hunger and still be richer than like 90% of us. Like 99% of us. He would still be in the top 1% if he ends world hunger. But again, there is no inclination for him to do so. And, you know, I'm not going to force him to do so. And I don't think that that's necessarily the right approach. But I also don't think that he should just have a vacant, $70 billion that he literally cannot do anything with, because of the fact that there is nothing of that high property that, or the, of that value that is beneficial to society. Like, again, it's the reason that Bill Gates invested and Bill Gates, in a sense, is still a philanthropist, but even so, what, he's donated like $20 billion and he's still like the top five richest man in the world. Like, you know how ridiculous that is, that you can donate $20 billion. And again, it's this idea that capitalism by and far is inherently propels ideas that I need to pay my staff as little as possible so that I can have as much gains as possible. And it's inherently evil. Now I want to talk about something that, you know, you mentioned Karl Marx, and I think that a lot of people get fascinated with this idea of Marxism and this idea that like socialism has to be exactly what Marx says. I think my favorite quote is, if Marx was so smart, why is he dead? You know, he died 200 years ago or whatever. Why is he dead if he's so smart? Marx said a lot of stupid things. He said, things that I inherently disagree with as well, which is what he has like a stupid quote on gun reform. Marx, let's see, on gun reform. Either way, I think essentially what he said under no pretext should arms and ammunition be surrendered. Any attempt to disarm the workers must be frustrated by force if necessary. So like, you know, Marxism, and if you're a gun rights advocate, you should love Karl Marx. And they're the ones that are complaining about Karl Marx, and I necessarily don't agree with everything that he has to say. And I think that socialism is a spectrum. Bernie Sanders is socialist, and so was Joseph Stalin. Now, is Bernie Sanders Stalin? No, by any means, no. I think that they have completely different intentions, and I think that, again, once you go so far to the right of capitalism, you end up becoming a socialist. And once you go so far to the left of socialism, you end up becoming a capitalist. And that's genuinely true. It's a circle. It's a spectrum. So we have to find a way that's going to benefit our society. And I think that just genuinely, there is no benefit to having someone have such a vast accumulation of wealth. Like what's the excuse for that? Like, what's the excuse that Jeff Bezos can, I understand again. And I'm not one of those people that's like, Jeff Bezos only donated $200. That's like or $200 million. That's like a drop in the bucket for him. Like, so what? It's $200 million more than you donated. We can't blame Jeff Bezos for a capitalist system that continuously puts wealth inside of his pockets. I mean, that's like literally on us as the people to make sure that that's not happening. So what's the solution, the capitalist solution, I suppose, if there is one, to this just vast discrepancy in wealth?
Jeff Bezos, kudos to you. I love what you're doing, but not in terms of what you're doing with distributing your wealth, but beyond that, you gain wealth.
But go for it.
I would never, if I had that much money, I would never not give it to my workers. I don't think you would. I think he's doing a vast disservice to himself by being up there and not donating. But I have no way to stop that, because if I do, it's oppression.
Yeah.
That's my opinion.
Sure.
I don't agree with it. Sure, I don't. But that is the pillar upon which my ideology is based.
Uh-huh.
And so you cannot agree with something to an extent, right? You can just say, I don't think Jeff Bezos is a good person. Sure. But is it enough to take that money away from his personal property, away from him? Democratic socialism is not socialism. Democratic socialism is the idea. Socialism is the idea that you have a socialist economy plus a non-democratic government, a dictatorship. Bernie Sanders is not a socialist. He's a democratic socialist, which means you would want to have a democratic government, a elected government, with socialism as an economic policy. There's a big and vast difference. And so when you talk about, you know, spectrum of socialism, there's also a spectrum of capitalism. And you keep saying about, like, you know, how I am on the socialist spectrum, not a pure socialist. Well, I have a counter. I'm not a pure capitalist. I am very much not a pure capitalist. I'm a far left capitalist, but I think that capitalism as a framework is good for society, because it just gives people the opportunity to, like I said before, to work, to bring society the economic production that they need. Capitalism needs reforms, but the way is not taking money away from the top 1%. Right, they can do what they want, but they stand a basis for what capitalism is, because when every 5-year-old, every 6-year-old looks up to what they want to be when they grow up, when they see these idols, it is Jeff Bezos, it is Bill Gates, and they are the epitome of success in America. And you can take it how you want. You know, Steve Jobs got his money, invested in a small house, did some donating, but he pocketed the money away. That's his choice. Bill Gates is donating a lot of his money. A lot of his money is going through philanthropic causes. Take that away. But I think the basis is that, you know, I can't influence what they're doing. It is their choice, because they made the money and they employed these workers and they built their own success. And so when you talk about how people are barred from getting success, first of all, people like Jeff Bezos, people like Satya Nadella, people like that were on the streets. They were kids and they were not. And Steve Jobs, to an extent, Steve Jobs was, and he's not the best person, first of all, to make an example.
Yeah,
of,
but definitely not.
Definitely not. But he was born in a one-story home, and he was born is big family issues, and he came to success. So capitalism is the story of the underdog. Now, the problem is that many underdogs are not being represented in capitalism. But the idea is that capitalism has given way to people like Jeff Bezos and Steve Jobs, but it bars people, right? The way to stop barring people in capitalism is by instituting reforms in other sectors, like criminal justice. The reason for why people are not given the fair opportunity that they deserve economically is because of other things. It's because of things like mass incarceration, which is not a byproduct of capitalism. It's not. And so when you reform these things, then we can achieve a better form of capitalism that gives fair opportunities and equal treatment to everybody. But it begins with looking at other sectors and looking at those issues. And once you solve them, and if the issue still persists, maybe look towards a different economic approach. Maybe, but right now it is by focusing on regulation and the other industries. I do have to leave, but we can part two this in the future.
We definitely can part two this. This is a conversation that's been happening for like 200 years, Rune. We can just make a whole podcast off of socialism versus capitalism. And again, I want to fully disclose, I by no means am defining myself as a socialist. I am arguing, in every sense, I'm playing the devil's advocate, right? And I'm interested in, I mean, the whole point of the podcast, frankly, is to have these conversations. And I'm not saying that Varun's argument is right and my argument is wrong and that, you know, socialism is the way to go and that capitalism is inherently evil. And I'm sure that Varun isn't saying that capitalism by any means is the best route of action. We're literally here discussing. And in the way that we're having these conversations about completely, like, I mean, like fundamentally opposed, like diametrically opposed ideas, like these are, you know, socialism or free market and control market, these two ideas, capitalism and socialism, are diametrically opposed to each other. One cannot, you know, you can't say that you're both. And we can have such, you know, an engaging and peaceful conversation about it. And that's what the whole podcast is meant to be. I mean, we're supposed to have times where we go, you know what, I'm wrong. And you, and I think that we're effectively having a discussion about something that, frankly, I think a lot of other media organizations fail to have a positive discussion about. And again, I want to reiterate that I'm not socialist, but I'm looking into learning. And it, you can literally be a right-leaning Republican that believes that that you know Donald Trump is the savior. You can be a QAnon supporter. I insist that you learn about socialism. I insist that you learn about the Karl Marx. I insist that you learn about Stalin and why, you know, according to some capitalists, socialist regimes have failed, or why socialist regimes have succeeded, and why capitalism has failed and why it has succeeded, and just become more informed and more informed as I'm attempting to do. So you might hear some socialist claims from me in the next, you know, the upcoming podcast and the discussions that we're having. But I'm sure in 2 months, you'll hear the complete opposite argument from me. But I'm interested in keeping this conversation going, and I invite all of our listeners to keep this conversation going within their own homes and to be intrigued to listen, whether it's on the right or left. As I discussed, I was trying to learn about the right and I ended up in the left. And I'm sure Varun's happy to hear that in a sense. But you know, go out and have discussions with your peers, as we're doing here on the podcast. I want to thank Varun for adding and for disagreeing with me today. I think this is the most that we've ever disagreed on a podcast, but it was good. It was amazing, maybe
last time even more, but both of them have been good discussions.
Absolutely.
Disagreements, but really good discussions.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Insane discussions. You know, I want to thank him for obviously adding his insight. And it's crazy that we interviewed Eric Schultz about 50 minutes ago, and now we're talking about Karl Marx and his views on gun rights. But nonetheless, ladies and gentlemen, like I said, go out and have these conversations. Go out and see what conversations we're going to be having in the upcoming weeks by following us on social media at Politatine Show, both on Twitter and Instagram. Be sure to check out our website, politatine.com. We actually just uploaded some pictures from a toy drive that we did that would not be possible without some of your donations and contributions and listening to the episode and keeping us morally uplifted. And with that being said, ladies and gentlemen, be sure to tune in to Monday's episode, I think it would be, or whenever we next upload. And with that being said, thank you guys so much. Goodbye.
Thank you so very much for listening to today's episode of Politatine. If you enjoyed our conversation, head on over to www.patreon.com/politatinepodcast. That is www.patreon.com/politatinepodcast to subscribe for exclusive members-only content, special episodes, and merch drops. Visit www.politatinepodcast for more amazing content from our sponsors. Thank you all so much for listening. Have a great rest of your day.